Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, and this is Peter Bregan. Glad as always to be talking to the best audience in the world, leaders, pioneers, great folks in the whole area of mental health, psychology, psychotherapy, research in our area, the best of psychology, sociology, anthropology. It's all about life. And again, it's just an honor every week to come on and talk with you. The people have wondered at times why I don't take questions. So I thought maybe I just mention why I don't. And that is because there's such a need for people to get information about their medications, and people are so desperate about it, that when I open to questions, people don't stay with the show. Folks just have such a need to talk to me about, you know, the medications they're on and other issues that are related to that. So it just seemed better to focus on my great guests and focus as much as I can on getting the best out of my guests about their lives and what they're doing and what they're thinking about and what they've struggled with. And don't forget that I got all those books out there and all those free articles on my website to try to answer your questions. And remember, too, I've got this whole big now antipsychotic resource center on my website. And then separately, we have a website that's Electroshock Resources Center, ECT Resources Center. So I do my very best to get the information out there in as much detail as I can. But the need is so great, I can't begin to dent the area of the millions of people, literally, who have important questions, personal questions to be asked. And I don't have an institute or, you know, a group of folks to support what I'm doing and to, you know, get on the phones and help people out. I wish I did. Next lifetime, maybe somebody else will start to do more and more of that. My guest today is Dawn Nelson. Dawn, I think you're there.
Yes, I'm here.
Your connection sounds good. I'm looking forward to talking with Dawn. I met her briefly at one of my conferences. Dawn has got an interesting background. She's a PsyD from Chicago, but not from the Chicago school I'm most familiar with, but from the clinical psychology school at Argosy, is that how it's pronounced? It's
yes.
A simple enough, mm-hmm. simple enough word. Argosy University School of Professional Psychology in Chicago. Of great interest to me, too, she also has a master's in divinity. I'm interested in talking to her today because she's a practicing psychotherapist. And she has worked really hard to have an ethical, caring practice and to carry it out in many ways in a much purer form than I have. She's gone all the way in tailoring her practice to the best theoretical and ethical approach, as we'll see as we talk. And whereas I've actually been a bit more practical in what I do, and I'm really glad to have somebody else on the phone. By practical, I mean I take insurance. That's probably the most important practical thing. And she does not. And I think that's all going to turn out to be very interesting. Dawn Nelson again is her name. Dawn, where are you practicing right now?
In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
How do people get in touch with you in Milwaukee? Are you in the phone book as Dawn R. Nelson?
No, I'm on Psychology Today. There's a therapist listing. In Psychology Today, people can search by zip code, name. So that's my... That's a big resource for me. And also your website.
You ought to go ahead and put your name on our website, too, on the...
I do. I have it on there.
Oh, good, good. Do you ever get any referrals from our website?
I do. I get a lot of referrals from your website. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's really great. Well, we were talking on the phone today and getting acquainted, and one of the things that interested me was the progression of your giving up, taking insurance, and feeling that was not an ethical or philosophically correct position. I think a lot of people who listen to this radio show probably struggle with that. So I'd be really interested in just having you tell us a bit more, tell us about that.
Okay. I accepted Medicare and Medicaid for about 8 years and other private insurances when I was practicing in North Carolina and as a provider with the National Health Service Corps. If those are required, it's serving the underserved community. So, there were some changes in North Carolina about who's going to be the administrator of Medicaid, and it came to be that they use local management entities. And I was familiar with the local management entity because I used to be employed there for my postdoc. So you sign a contract, and the contract was unacceptable to me. I had a lawyer propose amendments to the contract. They said no. So I said I won't accept Medicaid anymore. Basically, they would have been taking over my practice, telling me what clients I could accept and when I can go on vacation, et cetera. Join my office whenever one of their staff would like to. I believe those are inappropriate.
I didn't know they're so invasive. I stopped taking Medicaid and Medicare decades ago. But they were actually wanted to get involved with who you saw.
Yeah, they were going to tell me who I was going to see, and that's not appropriate. That's a distortion of the therapeutic relationship. You know, there's some people that you don't work well with, and you use your judgment and you call that, and and coming into my office and joining whenever they want to, that's not okay. None of that was okay with me. So I said I won't accept it anymore. And that meant I had to resign from the National Health Service Corps. So I did that, and I as well.
Tell me about you. Just have done things I don't know about. Tell me about the National Health Service Corps.
That is a government program that it's all over the country, and it's there to serve the underserved populations where professionals don't want to go. Basically, it's in underserved, remote, probably more isolated areas. And so there's criteria. Different places are more in need than others. So in exchange for serving in those communities, I received loan reimbursement for my student loans. So that's the return I got on.
I know what that is now. I know that physicians do that too. They get some reimbursement for medical training. I actually, now that you're talking about it, I did a couple of programs for them, sort of video conferencing educational programs for that very specific organization.
So you've been
service oriented since you got started too. That sounds like it's kind of shocking to say many professionals aren't necessarily service oriented, but you've been very service oriented. It sounds like from the beginning.
Yeah, Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Right, you agree to serve without regard to ability to pay. So based on a sliding scale, and sometimes there is no fee. So that's all part of that program. You agree to that.
And there's the program's main benefit to you is helping with your expenses. And is that with your training?
Yes.
Does that still exist for people who are interested in it?
Oh, yes. Yes, it still exists. And I do inform people about it. It's a way to continue education and pay it back someday. A lot of people worry about that. So I was determined to get in the program. And I was initially rejected because of my Master of Divinity educational loans. And I wrote a letter, and I was prepared to defend myself. Legal Center in Washington, D.C. was going to defend me as well if I needed them to. But they accepted me because I argued that what people believe in people's faith is absolutely pertinent to the practice of mental health, counseling, psychotherapy. So anyway, I was accepted into the program. I was determined that I was going to be.
Tell me, I didn't quite follow that. So there was an issue about your spiritual beliefs, or did I get lost there?
Yes, no. My student loans from Duke, my Master of Divinity degree, had been consolidated with all my loans were consolidated. So they said because your loans are consolidated and they include loans from your Master of Divinity, those loans are not valid and irrelevant, and therefore we won't accept you into the program. So I had to argue how that degree, that credential, was absolutely relevant to what I do.
Well, yeah, I mean, as your bio says, it focused on pastoral care and counseling. I can't think of a more relevant, I think a master's of divinity is probably often a lot more relevant than a master's in psychology to actually relating to people, inspiring them, helping them and understanding them. It's such a huge left out area in ordinary psychology and therapy. People come to me all the time, Dawn, and they believe in God. Often they have some particular religious beliefs, but they sometimes don't. But almost most of them think there's a higher power at the least.
Yes.
But any therapies they've been in before haven't even addressed it, haven't asked them, well, how do you handle your anxiety in relation to your belief in a God who loves you? And Do you actually talk much about that with you in your practice? If somebody is that way.
Well, yes, I do. If people would like to talk about it, and if it's if it's important to them, so that just means that I don't push my beliefs on people. And some people are agnostic and they're just not sure. And I guess that's okay. They can be that way. So I allow people to be where they are.
Yeah, I think that's the only direction to go in. But it is, as I'm sure you agree, so important to be open to the fact that most human beings do believe in God and have some mm-hmm. place in their lives for spiritual beliefs, and in particular, a relationship to God. And it can be very curative, very helpful, very good for their development to bring those to bear. Now, the other side of the coin, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is that many people have been religiously abused growing up or abused by religious people growing up. And so it's very hard for them to even imagine having any kind of spiritual life, because they think that it's a form of abuse. It's very common, but I just think that's about people who get abusive. It's not about the inherent value of a belief in God.
Right, and perhaps a distortion of religion, as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I studied this whole thing about God and human development, and in my honors thesis, my undergraduate honors thesis in philosophy. And so what I did is I compared Søren Kierkegaard and William James, their views on human health and development with Sigmund Freud's. And so I framed that it was about the reductionistic position of Freud on religion and James and Kierkegaard's anti-reductionistic position on religion. So James and Kierkegaard both said that in order to actualize potential and become, to flourish as human beings, people need faith and to believe in God. And of course, Freud said it's a lullaby. You know, you just want your daddy, grow up. So that was informing my studies before I went to Duke to study more about people's beliefs and how they relate to humanity and human behavior.
I think you're one of the few people who's been on the show that's mentioned William James. And I read a lot of him on my own in college. He was very informative to me. And his taking seriously the religious experience and his very practical arguments about why not to dismiss it, I think they had a big effect on me. The effects were mostly felt about 30 or 40 years later, probably. But even now, I occasionally find myself reading a bit of William James. And we don't have people thinking on the broad intellectual depth that he approached stuff with. I mean, he thought about everything.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think he said either believe in God and have faith because it helps you to live a strenuous life. It helps you get things done, the practical value, or I think rest in absurdity. And Kierkegaard said either believe in God, take that leap of faith, or live in despair. So those different perspectives of each of them.
Yeah, and I think that you're being kind to Freud. I mean, Freud was Freud really hated and resented religion. Some people think he wanted to be the new Moses, leading people to the new freedom. I learned a lot from reading Freud as a young person, but increasingly I found the weird ideas and the bitterness, the smugness and so on. I found it unacceptable eventually. So you were working on all that stuff as a relatively young person, as an undergraduate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, integrating all of them, philosophy, theology, and psychology. That's been my whole trajectory, academic and practice, integrating all of them.
Do you write it? Write it all. I'm talking, folks, with Dawn Nelson. Do you write it all? Do you blog or?
I used to write a column in North Carolina called Human Flourishing. So I wrote about subjects pertinent to human flourishing, humane psychology, politics and practice. Just different kinds of things. So I did that while I was in North Carolina. And since I've been here in Milwaukee, I do write. They only allow a person to be published every 2 or 3 months. So I recently was published. But I do write about things when I see perspectives about that are dehumanizing in terms of psychology and the biochemical model of depression and so I write about those things. I try to
And that's
raise
the
awareness.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that they accept writings, but only every few months.
Yeah,
you
got to
talk
right.
them into having. You got to talk them into having a column.
I have tried. I did propose that. As soon as I got here, I started them. And I proposed that I'd love to be a columnist. So far, I settle for them publishing my opinion.
Now, Dawn Nelson has a website where she talks about these very integrative ideas, and she and I certainly share that integrative approach. And it's the www.center, spelled S-C-E-N-T-R-E, C-E-N-T-R-E,
yes.
centerforhumanflourishing.com. What made you use, it's the English spelling, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I did that to honor a couple that I lived with in Scotland. I worked over there and did a semester, not a semester, I did an internship when I was for the British Methodist Church. And this was an elderly couple that welcomed me into their home, and I lived with them for the summer. So it's an honor to them for their welcoming me and their hospitality. Uh-huh. And they referred to me as their American daughter, and I called them my mom and pop.
So. Uh-huh.
That's for them.
Well, it's, you know, it's nice to talk with you. I mean, you're clearly somebody who cares about people, cares about folks, wants very much to help people, and you're also trying really very much to bring together a lot of different kinds of ideas. You started to give me when we were chatting a kind of an explanation for why you let go of doing, taking any kind of insurance, not just Medicare or Medicaid, but but any kind of insurance. And tell us about that.
Okay. Well, it's been my goal since I was accepting it. It had become a goal of mine to get off of it eventually and not be dependent on it. So, the first year here in Milwaukee, I accepted private insurance, one insurance company. And since I was only on one, it wasn't too much to get off of. So the beginning of last year, I said no more. I'm just going to pull the plug and go it alone. And the reason for that is that I believe that I have a lot of moral, ethical, legal, and philosophical differences. That I believe are irreconcilable with accepting insurance. I say to think of me as a conscientious objector. I just refuse to give fake diagnoses. The insurance model, the medical model, I refuse to make people sicker than they are or call bereavement depression or, you know, find problems for people when I think that, no, they just, there's a lot of reasons. There's multiple reasons, ethical conflicts, confidentiality, conflicting loyalties, medication, psychiatry. You know, I think that if you're treating somebody or working with someone that has depression, they expect you to be promoting antidepressant medication. Even if it has no, you know, the evidence isn't there for its effectiveness. So I don't want to be forced or coerced or be made to do that.
I agree with you 100%. I've opted to keep taking insurance because of just selfish reasons. Like, I can charge much more if I'm, letting people use their insurance. And I imagine that you have to charge less because you're not taking insurance. Does that turn out to be the case?
Well, I believe I charge a reasonable rate and, you know, just what people might like to pay. I don't think it's extravagant. There's people real close by me that charge twice as much as me, but, I think it's a reasonable rate. So I'm satisfied with what I what I charge. Yeah.
Well, I you know, I think you're doing it the right way. To whatever extent people can go out there and separate themselves from the system and do what they believe, I think is really obviously the best way to go. I think my being a psychiatrist, I get more left alone because it's a little hard for the insurance companies to complain when the psychiatrist says the patient doesn't need medication.
Because
you know, it says there have you referred your patient to a psychiatrist, or are you the treating psychiatrist? And or it comes out something like that, and I'm the psychiatrist. So it makes it a bit easier, I think, or put it another way, a little harder for them to push me to refer to a psychiatrist. Right, I am the psychiatrist. I think it's much harder for somebody, for everybody else, really. You've done a lot of different things. I mean, you were involved in working in Elgin, Illinois, at a medium security facility, and that must have again gotten you into a lot of issues of who you were representing. You were, tell us what you were doing there around this issue of not guilty by reason of insanity. I still do legal work that touches on those areas, and and you and I probably have very similar views on it. I can say a little about how I navigate it, but what was that like for you working in a situation like that?
Well, the year before I had done my training at a pastoral counseling center, so it was really quite different. And I had to learn that it's, you know, the concept of empathy, you know, the empathy, just being empathic with people, that certain populations don't understand empathy, and it isn't a means of communication. So I had to learn a lot about different ways of relating, and you know, with now, you know, the population.
Are you talking about the inmates or the staff?
Both. Yes, but no, I mean the population. But yeah, I had a pretty interesting supervisor while there.
Inmates of the facility, they were there for either not guilty by reason of insanity or unfit to stand trial. Those are the two places where psychiatrists really play God. And one is by testifying that somebody is not guilty by reason of insanity, which often is not a good outcome for the person. Maybe it saves them from a fixed life sentence, but it can be a life sentence. It's not generally a good outcome. And the other is unfit to stand trial, which is, again, not really a very good outcome, because you can end up in a criminally insane facility, which is in many ways, in times, worse than prisons. So it's a very complicated issue, and I try to avoid ever testifying on not guilty by reason of insanity or unfit to stand trial, except as it involves psychiatric drugs. So I'm not saying the person has a mental illness. I'm saying the person is neurologically impaired by drugs. And I only come in after the person's already made a guilty plea or something like that. And then I'll go back and say, well, this person was under the influence of psychiatric drugs. So, that kept them from knowing what, you know, from being able to stand up to themselves. I've seen people bullied by their lawyers once they got on drugs to accept a plea they really didn't want to make.
Right.
So, I'll participate as long as what I'm saying is on behalf of the client and is saying that at the time that they were going through this process or during trial, I would say it too, they they were whacked out on drugs, essentially, and that's neurologic. It's not a mental illness. You really don't have your brain function.
Yeah.
What about yourself? I'm sure you had a hard time with some of what was going on there. You did find that some of the inmates didn't respond much to empathy and caring.
Well, I was taught, and I had to read some books before I entered, Without a Conscience and different books, studying psychopathology. And so I was being trained from the very beginning that empathy isn't one way to relate to this population. So I had to find other ways to relate. And most of the population that I was working with were, you know, they were people who had murdered other people, a lot of times family members, or raped people, or, rape, murder, these kinds of things. You know, I heard a lot of very interesting stories about, you know, what people did to other people. And I was asked in one particular case to evaluate this man because there was a suspicion that he really, the not guilty by reason of insanity adjudication really was not appropriate, that he was really just a psychopath. And to evaluate it, because he had murdered his girlfriend. So I did a whole bunch of psychological assessments on him and studied him, and it was really just for the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist assigned me this task to assess it and to look at it, and he did have a lot of antisocial, psychopathic, probably character. I think it's probably fair to say a character organization that was, while I was at Elgin, psychopath, sociopath, antisocial were used all to mean the same thing.
Sure.
To refer to the same psychopathology, whether you're a psychopath or antisocial or...
Did you ever begin to doubt what you've been told? Because I have some doubts about it, and in the sense that I work with, you know, a fair number of people who have committed horrendous crimes, but they're not generally that population. They're generally decent folks who were never violent until they went on psychiatric drugs. So I don't have exactly the experience you do. The people I work with, I don't have much trouble relating to at all, especially once they're off the psych drugs. When they're on them, they can be lacking in empathy and lacking in concern and care and be real out of touch. But when they come off the drugs, the group I work with, you know, and that's partially my own selection, you know, if you've murdered somebody a couple of times, I don't generally take your case. Or if you've been violent before you were put on psychiatric drugs, I wouldn't take your case. I'm not sure I've ever taken a case where somebody had been violent and before they were on the drugs and then violent on them. Folks I work with who have killed people, you know, I don't have much trouble empathizing with them, but I think you're dealing with a different group of people. And were you convinced? Because you seem like you would be somebody who really would try to relate and care. Were you pretty convinced that was, you just get manipulated doing that? That it wasn't, that they weren't capable of genuinely saying, this person actually cares about me, maybe I'll experiment with trusting them a little bit?
I really believe that I tried to use a different means of relating. But again, it's particular to the person. Apply it, you know, to everybody. But I think there were some cases where you just try to learn about a person, because I wasn't doing any really in-depth psychotherapy. I was doing assessments. I was doing groups. So I wasn't doing any long-term psychotherapy with any of them. I think that some of them really were psychopaths. They really did just kill somebody, and they got the NGRI status. But in other cases, you know, there was a person who stabbed to death, a child less than 2 years old. And I think that sometimes, you know, I don't think that that was an intentional psychopathic act. I think that was, you know, some kind of a problem. People get confused and people get mixed up and psychotic, and they are not able to ascertain reality sometimes. And they they act out in ways. So I had to deal with those situations.
Sure. Just for people who have been involved in this field, it can be confusing that the not guilty by reason of insanity, the statutes in the various states literally exclude psychopathy, sociopathy, or whatever diagnoses refer to an individual who has no conscience, no remorse. Even though that is a diagnostic category in the DSM, it's not one that the statutes will allow to get you a not guilty by reason of insanity. It has to be more that you are so disturbed or psychotic that you, in many cases, it's the old you don't even know right from wrong. You're unable to know right from wrong at the time. Some places also allow you're unable to control your impulses or to understand the consequences of your actions. But it's about your ability to grasp what's happening when you take an action, that rather than somebody who consciously is able to plot and has no conscience. So even though you get a diagnosis for that, you don't get a get-home free card. On the other hand, as I say, the getting, quote, off on a not guilty by reason of insanity is often not getting off at all. Is that your experience, that the folks in the Illinois system, that they could just be held indefinitely?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think it's the same thing for unfit to stand trial. They could end up holding you indefinitely. And then you're at the whim of the psychiatrist, but the psychiatrist is also at the whim of the bosses, the administrators, and it's really it's no longer the rule of law. That's a good way to put it. Once you're subject to not guilty by reason of insanity or unfit to stand trial, you're no longer subject to the rule of law anymore. You have no protections. You're subject literally to the rule of men or people. And that often means the whims.
Right, you're incarcerated. I think that when I was there was a couple people that were unfit to stand trial while I was there that, if I'm recalling correctly, habeas corpus they were filing. Is that...
Yeah, they were finding habeas corpus. Their lawyers were trying to get them out on legal grounds.
Yeah. So that was
They didn't want to be there.
Right. And they were, whatever, they weren't becoming fit to stand trial. And, you know, how do you determine whether someone's malingering or not? But when I first went to North Carolina, I was hired by an attorney to do a criminal responsibility assessment. And this person had already been evaluated at Dorothea Dix and over in Raleigh, and the determination was that they didn't qualify for insanity defense. So, but the lawyer wasn't satisfied, so he said, well, I want you to do another one. And I really tried to get out of it after I accepted and said, I really don't want to do this. He said, well, so I had to do it, and I finished it. And because it was my determination that he didn't qualify, so I did not have to provide a report to the court, but I did testify in the Supreme Court on my assessment. It wasn't as bad as if I would have determined that he did qualify, because then it would have been some big report. So
I just had to testify. Yes, and you would have been cross-examined and so on.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So he didn't qualify.
In my experience, this would not literally, I mean seriously, it wouldn't pertain to you. But in general, folks, nobody working in the state system hardly ever finds anybody not guilty by reason of insanity. And you see it occasionally where somebody is so extremely psychotic that they imagine the other person is some unreal figment of their imagination, and they're grossly hallucinating and deluded. And so, I mean, on rare occasion, I've seen people working for the state, hired by the state or working in the in a state facility, make a that determination. It's very uncommon.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're glad to be free of all of that. Do you have
quite an education, an experience that I needed, but yes, I'm glad to be done with it.
Yeah. Are you enjoying private practice?
I am. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I want not accepting insurance and working part-time. It's what I wanted to do. It's very demanding work, and I like to help people with their problems and people that want help, and to provide a humane psychology. I do a lot of educating, and I introduce a lot of philosophy, and I do enjoy my work.
You mentioned to me when we were talking before the show that you that on your website you have the our guidelines for empathic therapy from the website.
Do.
Yeah, that's
cool. I've adopted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they fit perfectly with how I think.
Yeah, that I hope folks will go and look at that if you're a therapist or just interested in general. You know, go to empathictherapy.org and take a look at my guidelines for empathic therapy. I wrote them, and then I passed them by about a dozen of my colleagues, and they put their names on it, and some made it suggestions, and some said, no, that's just great. And someone on political grounds didn't like it because they literally wanted to be completely away from therapy and wanted political change. But it's all about treasuring the people you work with and caring about the people you work with and respecting them and their viewpoints and not diagnosing and not drugging. And I think it's great, Dawn, that you have that on your website. When did you become familiar with my work?
I believe I was, I don't remember what year it was. I'm trying to think. I became familiar with my work, your work, through my son. He was listening to you on the Lou Rockwell show, and he said, Mom, you've got to listen to this Dr. Bragan. So we listened to it, and... because he already knew I was talking to people about this and the drugging and the, you know, I was having to deal with people that were, you know, very much drugged. So I would
say
it was...
How old was your son at that point in time? You had to be a pretty young woman.
Well, let me see. He went to college later like I did. We didn't go right from high school. So I think it was around 2011 or 10 or 11. One of those years, and so he was in his late 20s that point. Yeah, late 20s he was then. He was opposed to college in the beginning, and then he went, and I went later as well. So that's how I heard about you.
And what was the first, did you read, most people who come on the show, turns out they read Toxic Psychiatry.
Well, I have that book because I was one of the founding members of the Empathic Therapy, your center. I was one of the founding members, and you sent me that book and signed it and sent it to me.
Oh, for God's sakes.
Yeah, so I have that book. I've read Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and... when I help people, I I've given that book, loaned it to people a lot, and sometimes it doesn't come back, but I still have a copy, another one, and or people buy it themselves, and so I ask them to read that book. And so they read that book.
Which book, the psych withdrawal or the toxic?
Psychiatric drug withdrawal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
good.
I have toxic psychiatry as well, and that's where I took that quote out that I was using in my ad.
Well, you can feel free to put that in your ad. This is a little embarrassing, folks, but Dawn came. I didn't know who Dawn was, and she came up to me at a conference, and she very proudly showed me her ad for her work and had a big quote from me. And for some reason, I was feeling sensitive about people using my name, and I thought that, well, I wasn't sure she should be using a quote from me as if I endorsed her work. But I love what you're doing, and I love your approach. Dawn tells me I was a little abrupt. So when I'm at a conference, sometimes my mind can be just spinning on my inside my head, and then my head's spinning on my shoulders. They may not even be going in the same direction. So I apologize to her. Now I do it on the air. I apologize for seeming to be abrupt or being abrupt, and I officially declare that you can certainly quote me on your website. I'm glad to end that cycle, which I only heard about when we were chatting today, and I was asking whether we had met. Was this at the Michigan conference? Are you there, Dawn? I think I've lost Dawn. Is Dawn there? I'm going to check with my engineer and see if Dawn is there. It's really good to talk to people who are doing therapy. I really believe in therapy. It's got a lot of complications to it. How do you choose therapists? How do you select them? How do you train them? But I meet people like Dawn on the air a little bit beforehand, and I think there are a lot of people out there doing good therapy and helping people. This is Dawn checking in. Hi, Dawn. Hello? Folks, I am here again. Let me talk a little bit about therapy. We've got 10 minutes left. And I hope that I'm being heard. I'm actually not even connecting with my studio right now.
Hi, Peter. I'm back.
You're back. Oh, great. I was just fumbling here and trying to figure out what was going on. Do you have any idea
what
happened? Did you get cut off?
No, yes. I just couldn't hear you anymore. So I don't know what happened.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, we're back.
Yes.
I'm so glad that my work has had a good influence on you. And I've said this to folks before. It's one of the things that's really nice about doing a radio show is how often it turns out that the folks that end up on the show, often people I don't know, very often people that Ginger has noticed on the internet, sound like interesting professionals. And of course, at other times, as you know, folks, I've had on friends of mine 4 or 5 times. We just had Peter Gerza on for 4 straight sessions for the month of December. By the way, folks, that is a wonderful series. If you want to hear 2 people talk who have devoted their lives to the scientific criticism of bad science, Peter in the whole field of medicine, Peter Gerze, and me in the field of psychiatry, the four-part series on PRN-FM that I did last month, the month of December, actually, is really powerful. And you can get to it on my website. Just go to the website and check my radio show, and you can actually look them up by name. You can actually put in a little search. Dawn, what sorts of things, anything we're leaving out that you'd like to talk about as we get near toward the finish line?
Well, I don't think so. I can't think of anything. We've talked about insurance and humane psychology and forensic psychology.
What do you think is the most help to your clients? Do you think it's the rapport, the relationship? Do you think it's the philosophy and psychology you wore for them? Do you have any sense of it? Do you get feedback on what they feel helps them?
I get feedback about their appreciation for me being a real person, just being a real person and not acting like I'm just a blank slate that they're relating to. I actually will use self-disclosure as I find it appropriate to do so, and they appreciate that. So I think just being a real person and, you know, confronting and talking straightforwardly and frankly. Sometimes I'm blunt, but I try to always be straightforward, forthright, with gentleness, and that's what I work on. So that I say what I think, and that's what I believe they've come to talk to me for, so that I will be honest and give feedback and don't, you know, neglect to talk straightforwardly.
Now, when I've taught graduate students in counseling, this is a whole new concept to them, to be yourself. You know, you have to rely on the boundaries. That's very helpful. But within the boundaries that you're not going to make friends and go out and date or have dinner,
right,
within the boundaries, being yourself is so important to people. They are so glad to have somebody who seems like a genuine human being, who's talking straightforwardly to them and being honest and direct and doesn't have a lot of gobbledygook inside their heads that they're applying to you. People
are really afraid,
with good reason. People are afraid that they're being studied like butterflies, you know, on a pin when they go to somebody for psychological help. And I'm glad you brought all that up. Those of you who are new in the field or in training, ultimately, it's about the kind of person you're going to be with the folks who come to you for help. Does that make sense to you, too?
Yes, absolutely. Just being authentic and genuine. And, being a person.
Caring. I'd put caring right up there with being genuine. And I think that what I've learned from people is that caring, being with somebody who really cares about them and is putting them first and thinking about what's good for them, how they want to lead their lives, and that this kind of a unconditional caring and even love, again within the very professional boundaries, that's another thing that people value a lot. Do you do much work on childhood? Do you go back and look at how childhood may be getting in the way with the mature adult living?
I do. Yes, I do. I try to kind of go back in order to go forward. Sometimes we have to go back to go forward. So, yes, we go back and try to understand how one became the person one is today, which includes being a child and an adolescent and how you felt and your relationship with your parents and what that was like for you and what it taught you about yourself or, you know, things that you misunderstood. So, yes, I do.
It's been very interesting to me how much kind of a consensus there is that's evolved in the recent decades among people who do therapy and like doing it. At least mm-hmm. the kinds of folks that I meet, who come to my conferences, whom I talk to on the radio. There's this general consensus about being real, about caring, and also, though, about doing this kind of work. I hate to call it analytic work, psychological work, where you you look at how you became the way you are. What were your experiences? I talk a lot about approaches that have that we've learned in childhood that don't work in adulthood. It may have kept you alive in your childhood to never assert yourself with a brutal pair of parents, but it won't work in adulthood to not assert yourself. It may, you know, things like that. It may have gotten you by in childhood to blame yourself for everything, because that way your mother acted like she loved you.
Right.
But it doesn't work in adulthood. So, but that makes sense to you too?
Yeah. Yep. That's right. You know, whatever defenses that you're using or you developed as a child, you know, you should be able to identify them and see how they're working for you or not.
I talk about this in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. My most recent book, Dawn, is an attempt to show how guilt, shame, and anxiety may have helped us during evolution and got built into us as very quick responses to conflict in the family, but how we don't need to live by them. We can live by love and by reason. We don't have to live by being battered by feeling guilty, feeling ashamed, or feeling anxious. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that we should understand that if we feel that way, understand it and understand where it came from, and evaluate whether it's useful today, and perhaps we could look at things a different way today. A couple of things you said at your you've said today, and you also said at your conference that stood out in my mind, where you brought up the importance of the role of the mother. I think that you said it was the most important for a child, the mother's role, and then, like you said, the role of love, that we really help people by loving people in the sense of right, appropriate boundaries. I view it as the agape love, the Christian love, where we, not erotic love or filial love, but it's the genuine Christian agape love. So those are a couple things that you said that stand out in my mind, the role of the mother and how important you believe it is, and how in loving people.
And I think people in many ways, and it's a wonderful note to end on. We're coming to the end, and it's a great note to end on. I do believe that, and often part of what we're doing in our relationship is reparenting each other. In therapy, we, in a way, provide some parenting people maybe didn't have. And I know in my relationship with Ginger, we're just always reparenting each other and providing the kind of unconditional love that we might at one time or another missed. Dawn Nelson from Milwaukee, Dawn R. Nelson. She's a PsyD, and she's got a master's in divinity. And it's just a pleasure to have you on the radio show. Just a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dawn.
Thank you.